didn't want to say, "No, honey, that designer's a huge deal, and you've been in one movie that hasn't come out yet," so you both pretend the email never happened. The first time I went to my stylist's house and pawed through a rack of dresses, it felt like Christmas. When I tried them all on, it felt more like Christmas without presents, food, or alcohol. Her distinctly unfamous client was not a big selling point for designers to give up their best stuff. You can only try on so many olive green paisley numbers before you seriously consider creating a dress from toilet paper and bedsheets. But buried in this mountain of lamé and brocade, there was one gorgeous soft pink marquesa. I still don't know how she got it. I don't know if the dress was lined in asbestos, or if they owed her a favor, or if she stole it out of a pile reserved for Anne Hathaway. I had no credits, but we got a marquesa. And the fucker fit. Also, I learned that things which I thought fit didn't fit. Fit to me now means it looks more like a piece of clothing than a garbage bag, and it can be made to fit with extensive tailoring. We decided to go with the pink dress, and after we got it tailored and found a bra that didn't show, my stylist asked me about shoes. She thought it was important that I wear a pair of expensive shoes, not just dressy-looking shoes, actual expensive shoes. It turned out magazines were going to decide how seriously to take me based on whether I wore designer shoes or shoes that looked nice but didn't cost enough to feed a family for a month, like some kind of phony. She came to my apartment with three pairs of shoes in a shopping bag and said we should pick a pair and she'd return the rest. The Louboutins are a little pricier than the others, but it's your first big premiere, and I think they're really special. Okay, how much are those? $1,099. Dollars? $1,000? That's more than my rent, like a lot more. Maybe you've noticed that I live with two dudes and sleep on an IKEA twin bed? Or has living in a world of luxury for so long left you unable to recognize the signature lines and craftsmanship of the Malm collection? For context, my stylist was earning more to dress me for up-in-the-air-related events than I did for making the actual movie. There was a feeling from the people around me at that time that, although I hadn't made much money yet, things were about to start going so well that huge checks were right around the corner. I should spend whatever I had to, even if it seemed imprudent because I'd have tons of money in just a few months. I'm glad I was such a tight-fisted bitch because the money didn't follow for about 2 years. In fact, Twilight was the only thing keeping me above water. I've said in the past that without that series I would have been evicted, and people think I'm joking. Nope. Me and my Oscar nom would have been living in my car. Which is a charming story now, but at the time I did not find it funny. The shoe situation, though, seemed like a necessary evil. Apparently, I was now trying to convince the world that I was a movie star, and movie stars had companies like Louboutin begging them to wear their shoes, and to pretend that was happening, I would have to buy a pair. I paid $1,000 to trick people into thinking I got free shoes. I wore the shoes in Toronto with my awesome and inexplicable Marquesa dress. No one seemed to care one way or the other about what was on my feet, but maybe it's one of those you-only-notice-if-it's-Aldo kind of things. I still have those shoes. I don't think I've worn them since. If they go out of style or I join a cult that eschews material goods, or if both my feet are eaten off by the army of cats I'll eventually own, I'll never get rid of those shoes. Yes, it's the ultimate irony that now I can't afford a pair of shoes like that, but designers let me borrow them for free. When you think about it, though, all these celebrities are borrowing shoes that have been worn by someone else before them. Like bowling shoes. So the joke's on us. That story makes my stylist sound crazy, which she wasn't. She was just used to the fashion world. I'd encountered this behavior before when I did a photo shoot for Teen Vogue with the cast of Rocket Science. I loved the shoes they put me in, and the magazine's stylist said, "Oh, they're actually from the designer's diffusion line, so they're not that expensive. I think they're like $600 or $700. Cool. That's when I started cutting the labels out of the clothes I wore to fashion shoots, lest they see an Old Navy tag as I undress and kick me out of their studio. A good sport. A few nights before the Oscars, I was invited to a party thrown by Louis Vuitton. When a fashion house throws a party, they send clothing options to the invitees so that no one shows up in Chanel and rips apart the space-time continuum. My stylist was beaming as she showed me a beautiful white coat and a pleated tartan mini dress. I put it on and immediately said, "Oh my god, it's like a high-end slutty schoolgirl costume. It's amazing." It was weird, but it was cool and I liked it. I looked like a luxury tramp and it was a nice change of pace from what I'd been wearing during all the Oscars press. When I got to the party and started to take off my coat, the woman next to me looked at my dress and said, "Is that what they sent you to wear? Oh, you're a good sport." I put down my drink. I needed both hands to tie my coat back up tight enough that it wouldn't show a square centimeter of my dress. I spent the rest of the night readjusting my collar higher on my neck, and only when the house photographer stopped me in the hallway on my way out did I take my coat off, praying that no one would pass by. All the photos that ran in fashion land the next day were of me in a voluminous white coat. I met with my stylist to look at Oscar dresses and said, "Oh man, you won't believe what I did last night." "No, I saw. She was a little terse.
Right, it's just that this woman, like, said I was a good sport for wearing the dress and it felt like a dig and...
She said that? She saw what you were wearing and felt moved to say something passive-aggressive to you?
Yeah, basically.
Wow, she said with a smirk. She felt so provoked by a fucking dress that she took a swipe at you? That's pathetic. Man, if you're messing up someone's day with what you're wearing, you're doing something right.
I liked that. That even someone from the fashion world was like, dude, it's just fashion. It's supposed to be fun.
No one had prepared me for this part. I didn't know I was going to have to learn about fashion. I thought I knew plenty about fashion. I knew gowns were more formal than short dresses, skirts were more formal than pants, and leaving the house in just socks and a sports bra would get you arrested. Now you're telling me there's more to fashion than finding a dress that shows enough boob to distract from your face?
I struggle with fashion because growing up the way I did, it felt like something explicitly designed to distinguish people with money from people like me. Reading a magazine that said I was supposed to have some new bag or dress I couldn't afford felt like crap. Now I get to wear these beautiful dresses and it's hard to reconcile. The first time I went to a fashion show, I went backstage afterwards to meet the designer. I expected her to tell me the dress was really intended for someone less pasty and walk away. But she was nervous. She was almost beside herself. She was asking me what I thought of the show and telling me she wasn't going to read reviews until the next day so that no matter what, she could at least enjoy the fruits of her labor for the rest of the night. She'd studied and worked for years. She'd crafted the pieces meticulously with the best materials and construction. This was her art, and I was looking at it like it was a corporate conspiracy to make me feel insecure. Fashion is an art form and an expression of self. Creative outlets are hard to find, and if fashion is yours, go deep with it, baby. I can't wait to see you shine. But if you're feeling crappy because you accidentally scrolled through Gigi Hadid's Instagram, remember, it's just fashion. It's supposed to be fun. Now, going to events that are important to me or to colleagues is a part of my life. I'm grateful to have anything to celebrate in my world, and if current custom dictates that I look halfway decent, I don't want to disrespect that. I want to honor the event that I'm at and the designer who allows me to wear their work. I'm glad I got to see the vulnerable person behind an intimidating fashion show. I'm also grateful that someone shook me out of my protective shell of self-righteousness. It's healthy, even though I like my shell very much. There will always be people who use fashion as a status symbol, but I don't want to be friends with those people anyway.
Oh, honey. Now I know just enough to know that I don't know anything. I learned there's something called a bias cut, which means it's going to look terrible on you unless you're Giselle. I learned that nude shoes make your legs look longer, and I learned that before going out, you should shine a very bright light at your crotch to make sure you can't see your puss. Short girls, get it tailored. For God's sake, get it tailored. The wardrobe designer on Pitch Perfect, Sal Perez, hammered this home for me because we don't wear business clothes or silk dresses in those films. We wear t-shirts and denim jackets, and still, alterations are made. I used to just deal with the extra fabric that bunched at the bottom of my jeans until Sal had me try on a pair of rag and bone. I flew out of the dressing room. This is amazing. It fits so well, even in the inseam. I admired myself in the mirror, then sheepishly asked, "Does it fit because it's a cigarette cut?" Sal put his hand on my shoulder. "Oh, honey, it's a capri." So non-capri pants might need hemming, but it's totally worth it. Just because it's not a luxury item doesn't mean you're a dick for getting it altered. Also, take in the sleeve. That's the best trick I've learned for getting tops and jackets to look right on us shorties. Don't just take the sleeve up at the wrist. Take in the width of the sleeve. It's a game changer. The same is true of men's suits. Men, even more so than women, seem to think that getting something to look good is about going up in price. But tell your boyfriend to get a less expensive suit and have it tailored. Please, as a service to me. Wear the Spanx. You might not want to squeeze them over your ass in the morning, but when you see that mac and cheese at lunch, do it, you beautiful monster. You'll be glad they're there, doing the Lord's work. Never, ever, even if she is on the brink of hypothermia, let your taller, blonder friend borrow your favorite peacoat. You look good in that coat, but she will look better, and you will never be able to unsee it. This is not based on me, or a Topshop coat, or my friend Leah. If you want real fashion advice, you should look up Alexa Chung or Olivia Palermo, who, while they're good at lots of other stuff, are known for wearing clothes really well. I would argue that the most honest fashion advice they could give would be tall, thin, and gorgeous, and have a monthly budget of around $500 for maintaining your hair. But if you look them up, I'm sure that every interviewer has asked them, "What's your best fashion advice?" And they have answered, "Wear what makes you feel confident." By the way, who has that helped? What girl is out there thinking, "Damn it, I've been wearing my least favorite articles of clothing because I thought you were supposed to feel dumpy and shy. Clothes aren't supposed to make you want to avoid human contact." Thank you, Olivia Palermo. Thank you.
I'm just being shitty. It's a lame question because there's no good answer. These girls have their quote down and they stick to it, so keep climbing, ladies. Sidebar, the only reason I feel bad about bringing them up is that at some point, Alexa and Olivia will be asked on some red carpet, what do you think of Anna Kendrick's burn in her book? And they'll have to go, who? And then their publicist will tell them and they'll have to say something like, oh, she's entitled to her opinion, or she's obviously just kidding, or hopefully, what a cunt. And then the fun really begins. I get to wear fancy clothes and I get to have my hair and makeup done, and being a little brat about it is stupid. I also have to wear fancy clothes and have my hair and makeup done. And anything in the world that you have to do can become tiresome. If you had to play with a puppy every day, okay, that's not a good example, that would always be fun. But someone poking at your eye with a makeup brush is not as fun as a puppy. You'll just have to take my word for it. Making movies is a fool's errand. I need a lot of sleep. More sleep than I'd like. I wish I could be one of those people who thrives on 5 hours a night, but I really need 7 or 8, just to function. I'll happily take 9. 10, if you're offering. I'm actually gonna lie down for a minute. Okay. That was nice. Maybe I need more iron in my diet. I bring it up because on a film set, sleep becomes the ultimate commodity. The hours are fucking bananas. We're certainly not curing cancer, but man, do we stay at work like we're trying. All you do when you're making a movie is sleep and go to work. You're staying in a hotel or a rented apartment, miles and often several time zones away from anyone you know. It's hard to see outside the little world you're in. You can't get perspective because for the duration of the shoot, nothing else exists. So you're at the mercy of the people around you. The group that you are working with, aka your only waking companions, will dictate whether you're going to spend a few months euphoric or miserable. Sometimes it's awesome. When you know there's a ticking clock on your relationships, it's fun to get way too close too fast. Why pace yourself? You won't even have time to get sick of each other. You jump into intense friendships, and it's bittersweet and wonderful. Sometimes you don't like the people you're working with. It's temporary, but facing another 16-hour block with people you don't like can feel insurmountable even when you know it's only for a few months. Getting on Skype with your best friend to talk shit helps, but you gotta go to sleep and do it all over again in 6 hours, so make your shit talk count. I try not to let it, but my personal feelings can affect how I approach filming. I once got into a debate with a director because I didn't understand why I would kiss the actor in the scene with me. I felt like there was simply no motivation for them to kiss in that moment. The director pointed out that we were playing boyfriend and girlfriend, and couples tend to kiss. Oh, right. So we kissed. But I wasn't happy about it. It's also hard to gauge how well a scene is working if you don't get along with someone in it. Once you know someone is an asshole, it's hard to find anything they say funny, charming, or poignant. I find myself thinking, I wouldn't believe this guy if he warned me about an impending nuclear fallout. He's an asshole. Sometimes, though, nothing bonds a cast like a common enemy. For an independent film I once did, an acting coach was hired. I've never been sure why, it's certainly not common practice. She took herself very seriously, so we felt we had to take her seriously as well. We did an exercise in pairs where we ran across a room toward each other and jumped as high as we could at the point of intersection. After a while, my woefully unathletic ass said, "Hey, I'm sort of out of breath here, can we take a break for a second?" "No, keep going, jump higher." "Are you my Soviet gymnastics coach? I thought we were all adults, and I thought we all kind of understood that this acting exercise was new age bullshit." I prepared to run at my partner. Fuck me, now I've got to commit twice as hard or she might make me keep doing it. But that's the trouble with being an anemic little weakling. You can't just draw from your reserve of energy and focus because you don't have one. It was immediately clear that I wasn't going to improve, so she had me do enough runs to conceivably be satisfied and said, "That was great work. Much better, Anna." We thanked her for all her help and left. That night, the whole cast went to dinner, and one of the men was the first to break. "Okay, that lady was crazy, right?" The rest of us couldn't agree fast enough. I ended up feeling closer to that cast than to most others. If I ever direct something, I'm going to hire one crazy person so that everyone else gets along. Film sets are unpredictable. It's like trying to put together a wedding every day in the middle of an uncharted forest. Sometimes literally. More on that later. There's an expression about how you can account for everything. Dot your I's and cross your T's. Be totally prepared. Then an elephant escapes from the zoo and runs through your set. I was shooting a movie in a tiny town in Indiana. I mean tiny, like stables in the Walmart parking lot for the Amish residents tiny. It should have been ideal for shooting because there would be no interruptions. Once we started filming, though, we noticed something. Trains came through the neighboring town about every 10 minutes. No one had heard the sound before because in the whole time they were scouting locations, they never stood perfectly still and quiet in a room for 10 minutes. Unfortunately, that's all you do on a film set. The flat landscape and paucity of residents ensured that the sound carried perfectly. About 2/3 of everything we shot was unusable. Making movies is a fool's errand. It's madness. And there's never a guarantee that it will work. And yet people keep coming back. Business people who are smart enough to know better keep investing in movies. Kids keep going to film school. M. Night Shyamalan can't be stopped. And for some reason, neither can I. Nudity. Nudity really isn't for me. Why? I've tried explaining it to people, but it seems you either immediately understand or you don't see what the big deal is. I don't mind a sex scene. A character can be having a sex scene. But my physical parts always feel like mine, because they are. See, it's hard to put into words. I don't object to the use of nudity in film. It can add realism and intimacy. And by the way, more power to the actors who are comfortable with it, but for the time being, it's not for me. I did once get to choose my own butt double, for a scene where so little of my butt showed that I doubt anyone really noticed that it happened. Having never done it before, I was relieved to find out that the selection process is not done in person. Instead, I was handed a black binder to look through. Inside was a small collection of Polaroids, naked girls against a white wall, shot from the neck down. It looked like something out of The Silence of the Lambs. First of all, I don't know why they'd been photographed from the front at all. I was only looking for a butt double, and the frontal pics just made me feel like an even bigger creep. I still looked, though. And second, as I perused my butt options, I realized I didn't know what my own butt looked like. It's behind me all the time, and even when I look at it in a mirror, I'm usually twisting my body around to see if that tender spot is a pimple or if I sat on thumbtack. I inspected the selection of anonymous bottoms, and just as I was about to say, "I think this girl looks like me," the female producer casually pointed to my impending choice and said, "Well, this one's butt is a little square. I think we can rule her out." What? Is that a thing? I didn't know a butt could be square. Do I have a square butt? You know what? Don't tell me. Kissing. I don't find kissing scenes fun at all. I had assumed this was a lie actors had to stick to because admitting it was awesome would make them seem creepy or piss off their spouses. There's always talk of how people are standing around and it's awkward and you're doing it over and over, but that didn't seem like enough to negate the awesome to me. I always thought that if I got to do kissing scenes, I'd toe the party line, but deep down I'd be thinking, we basically get to cheat here without getting in trouble, so it's kind of great. And I've heard that some people do think it's great, so bully for them, I'm envious. But I find it totally clinical. It's not about the people standing around, it's about the fact that the other person doesn't want to be kissing you, they're obligated to do it. They might not be horrified, but it wasn't their decision. I could try saying, "Hey, is there any chance that you're, like, secretly into me? Because if you were, it would make this work assignment we're about to do way more fun for me." But that doesn't seem super professional. Most of the time, I don't even remember anything about it. I have been excited about kissing a co-star precisely one time. One time. And it wasn't even until after the fact. I won't name names since I don't want to embarrass him, but let me recount this tale quickly. A couple of years ago, I did a small role in an improvised film as a favor to a friend. I had a short scene with a handsome movie star. Our movie backstory was that we'd had a fling in the past, we were friendly now, and it was all a little flirtatious, but we weren't serious about each other. There was no plan to kiss, just some light chat. As for my real-life backstory, I'd had a crush on this actor as a teenager, so maybe I should have been nervous and excited to work with him, but my character had to give him stitches on his face, on his handsome movie star face. I needed to concentrate on not drawing blood at any point. The only thing that stood between his face and the very sharp, very real needle in my hand was a layer of latex prosthetic as thin as fresh prosciutto. I also knew that he was the kind of committed actor who wouldn't stop the scene to say, "Ow, that's my actual face you're ripping into, so hey, maybe we should cut." Halfway through the evening, I still hadn't permanently scarred any co-workers, and as we got more comfortable with the scene, the director leaned in and said, "It felt like you guys were going to kiss in that last take. I think that's a good instinct. Maybe we should go with that." Okay. We each got a mint, and for a few takes, we stumbled through the double awkwardness that is kissing on screen without an exact cue to do it. At the end of the night, I went home happy with the work we'd done and relieved that no flesh was harmed. I drove all the way home, pulled into my driveway, and as I was putting the car in park, suddenly shrieked, "Oh my God! I just made out with Legolas!" Again, I'm not going to name that actor as I wish to respect his privacy. Budget. Into the Woods was one of the biggest budget films I've ever worked on. It made the production glorious. Every single detail in that film was designed with love and passion. The world created by Rob Marshall and his team was so rich, I felt inspired and grateful on a daily basis in a way that is very unusual for me. A larger budget enables a fully realized vision, but it inspires overcomplicated solutions to non-problems. It also has some comical side effects. There's a scene in Into the Woods where Cinderella runs down the palace stairs, but Prince Charming has covered them in sticky tar to keep her from getting away. As that scene approached, someone asked me to try on my magnet shoes. My what? No one had bothered to ask me, but some mystery higher-up assumed that I wouldn't be able to stop in my tracks unassisted, and tasked several departments with fitting both the stairs and my shoes with powerful electromagnets. The idea was to switch them on as I ran full speed down concrete steps. Now, this was not only a spectacular waste of time and resources, it was kind of a fucking death trap. Even if it worked, I would surely be sent flying out of the shoes and into some corrective surgery. I had to do a couple of runs to prove to Rob that I could successfully mime being stuck in goo, and I let the special effects guys turn on the magnets when Cinderella struggles to pry her shoes up by hand so that everyone could feel like Operation Electro Murder had been a justifiable project. My second favorite thing about that scene was that Chris Pine, who played the prince, had to stand there the whole time. Both of us assumed he'd come in for an hour in the morning, they'd shoot some footage, and through movie magic he would appear frozen in time at the top of the stairs. No such luck. Poor Chris had to stand there and watch me do that number 100 times. I was running, crawling, falling down, jumping up, and belting my stupid face off for 2 days straight, and with every action, he trudged back into position and endured another take. I'll admit I found this situation amusing. Every time he complained, it just gave me an easy opening to say, "Oh, I'm sorry that you had to work hard today. Can somebody get Chris a medal?" Here's the thing. I really felt for him. A long day at work is made abnormally grueling by the absence of productivity or accomplishment. For all the physical and mental energy I was expending and bruises I was getting, I left those 2 days so contented and satisfied. He left them needing a burger just to get a little dopamine flowing in his brain before we had to start all over again. There were also 2 small fires on that set that no one seemed to be that worried about. I do mean small, but still. A scrim and a prop lantern, which was not built for actual flames, caught on fire, and there was no real sense of hustle. This was a big budget film, and there was a department for that. This is how a room full of adults ends up staring at a rapidly growing fire with their mouths open. The previous year, I'd been shooting the movie Happy Christmas with a total of 6 crew members and about 4 principal actors. If there'd been a fire, all 10 of us would have run to a water source. Unless it was a grease fire, we're filmmakers, not idiots. Debatable. When you're on an independent film, you have to wear more hats. It isn't stressful, though, because you start to feel capable and relish the responsibility. Happy Christmas was shot in 11 days for about $80,000. For perspective, that's 1/262nd the budget of Silver Linings Playbook. There was no script, no paper involved whatsoever, and we didn't tell anyone we were doing it. Aspiring filmmakers, isn't it great news that you can make a movie for so little, and more important, that you don't need to ask permission? It was the happiest and most productive set I've ever been on. I'm not saying small-scale movies are always better off on the whole. I don't want the next Bond film to be improvised and shot handheld. You can't make a movie about an alien werewolf invasion with 10 people and 80 grand. And I want to see Fur from the Sky by 2018. Wardrobe. I've wanted to work on a period piece for as long as I can remember. A fantasy period piece even more so. I got my wish with Into the Woods, and it was everything I dreamed it could be. And a little less. Turns out authentically made corsets are quite small. They seemed bearable in my fitting, but any woman who's ever tried on shoes in a store knows you can think something is perfectly comfortable only to wind up begging for mercy at the end of your first day in them. In between scenes, I could ask to have my corset loosened and get some relief. I couldn't do it myself because of how it was made. But inevitably, it had to get laced up again. This led to an unusual dynamic between Asia, the on-set dresser, and me. I adored Asia. She was funny, hardworking, and sweet, but she was responsible for putting me in a moderate degree of physical distress. If your best friend gave you a Charlie horse 10 times a day, you'd feel weird about her, too. So after a few weeks, whenever I saw Asia, lovely Asia, whom I really liked, it struck fear into my heart. We would eye each other across the set, awaiting the telltale signs of camera readiness. This equally tiny blonde and I would get locked in a stare down like Bull and Matador. Eventually, I'd lose focus and Asia would creep up behind me. "Oh, Asia, hi, are we sure that they're ready? I thought they were waiting on the animal wrangler to bring the cow," I said, stalling. "Nope. Tug, tug, tug. The cow's already set. Tug, tug, tug. Dion's just swinging a lens and then pictures up." I'd get desperate. "Oh, tug, tug, tug. I feel like The cow always runs away a couple of times before we actually shoot, though, so maybe just a few more minutes. But she was the matador, and she skewered me every time. Our legendary costume designer, Colleen Atwood, had every piece we wore custom-made and hand-picked the perfect fabrics, laces, and buttons. Even the shoes were made by hand. The skirt on Cinderella's rags was a dusty blue linen. It was humble but lovely, the perfect choice for cinders. But linen is a fabric that wrinkles like Jack Nicholson's balls without Botox. So I'm working in a corset and heels for 16-hour days, but every single time I sit, just sit down and have a little rest between takes. Someone has to steam my skirt because it now has some minor wrinkles in it. I'm Cinderella, by the way. My body, my hair, every part of my costume has been painstakingly covered in soot and grime and grass. God forbid my skirt isn't freshly pressed. The most annoying part was that Colleen was right. It really did look better smooth. Dirty and disheveled added to the aesthetic, but wrinkled was distracting. It was this major production, Disney's Christmas tent pole, and I couldn't even sit down. So in between takes, I'd walk over to a chair or a bench and just look at it, longingly. Sometimes I'd lean on it or circle it like a cat. People on that set probably thought I had hemorrhoids. My wardrobe on Up in the Air was perfectly curated for my character, but it felt so unnatural to me, as did the rest of my look, the hair and the makeup, that I started to feel claustrophobic in it as the weeks went on. I bought some glittery nail polish in an alarming shade of blue and painted my toes so that I could be in control of one small corner of my body. Natalie would never wear something so juvenile, but I liked knowing that under my perfectly tailored skirt suit, I was still messy and strange. My tiny act of rebellion was discovered on the day we shot a scene at airport security. I had counted on Natalie always wearing closed-toed shoes, but even in movie land, the TSA is unflinchingly scrupulous. I pulled at the toes of my nude stockings until enough material gathered to obscure my sparkling nails. Our costume designer, Danny Glicker, as acerbic as he is brilliant, looked me up and down and raised his eyebrow. Your secret's safe with me, but that's an unfortunate look. No one else on set seemed to notice. That scene was cut anyway. Perhaps test audiences were thrown by how guilty Natalie looked during a simple airport security check. Keeping up appearances. When you start a new film, you come to work looking nice for the first week. Then, inevitably, you remember that you are in your personal clothes for 30 minutes each morning and your costume for the next 15 hours. All right. Same pair of sweatpants every day for a month, here I come. By week 3, if an actor is still coming into work in a full outfit at 4 a.m., you can be sure they're banging someone on set. The same is true for your appearance from the neck up. You show up looking like hell on toast, and lucky for you, some poor sap has to put your face and hair into some recognizably human arrangement before the first shot. I've been told that I have working girl hair. I like this expression because it sounds like my hair is a swarthy, streetwise prostitute in 1930s New York. It's actually a reference to the damage your hair goes through when you're on a film set. The more movies you make, the worse the damage is from blow-drying, curling, coloring, etc. In this sense, the term's supposed to be worn as a badge of honor, a testament to your work ethic, like calling your dark under-eye bags success circles or ambition sacks. What it actually means is that your hair is wiry and brittle with thin ends, and will need even more blow-drying, curling, and coloring to be made camera-ready. I had very curly hair when I was growing up, but I willed it away, and now my hair dries naturally into gentle waves. I heat style my hair every day so I don't look like Dale Dickey in Winter's Bone. I used frizzies for years until my first on-set hairstylist pointed out that the frizzy before picture was just a straight-haired model who'd been photographed with messy hair through some contrivance. I'm sure the look was achieved with a crimping iron and some back combing, but I felt so betrayed that I liked to imagine the model had run afoul of a rabid squirrel. In the hair and makeup trailer on my second film, rumors started to swirl about miracle flat irons from Japan. Previous generations of flat irons made your hair less curly, yet somehow bigger and angrier. But not these. They were smaller, they were hotter, they'd transform you into the Amanda Bynes silk nymph you'd always wanted to be. Think what a girl wants, not mugshot. The cost of becoming this new woman? Almost $200. Straight-haired women, don't you judge me. Cheap curling irons are completely fine, but flat irons don't work like that. The hair department bought one, and I used it on the days I had the energy for the Sisyphean task of straightening my hair 1 inch at a time, knowing the process would begin anew upon the next wash. I had to get one for myself. I had no money, but you bet your ass I put that bad boy on a credit card. I couldn't go back to being book Hermione when I'd had a taste of being movie Hermione. If that reference went over your head, in the books, Hermione's supposed to be ugly. In the movies, she's Emma Watson. Also, in the books, she fixes herself with magic. So nothing is fair. You don't normally have your nails done on a film set. It's fine by me. I'm heavy-handed and I don't like sitting still. but I was recently talked into having bi-weekly manicures for a film. People will tell you that gel manicures won't ruin your nails as long as you change them out every 2 weeks, but if you ask me, they are filthy liars. Maybe by the time this book comes out, the gel manicure will be a thing of the past, like electrolysis or those Anna Nicole Smith diet pills I definitely never took. Just in case, please let me share my painful experience. I wore gel nails for 3 months on this movie, and when they finally came off, my boyfriend wouldn't let me touch him. My nails were so thin that they sliced and diced anything I came near. I was a human paper cut factory. I gain weight on every movie. Never, ever have I left a set without putting on at least 5 pounds. You're not sleeping enough, you give up on exercise, and there is food everywhere. But the curse of the lady actor is to reach down deep, past the gurgling stomach acid, and find some willpower. When I'm trying to keep my ass in check, you'd think that fellow ladies would help me stay motivated. Instead, we end up torturing each other and ourselves. A group of hungry actresses, aka actresses, will talk about food with the kind of fervor and specificity normally found in Star Trek fan fiction. Some deep, hardcore stoner shit. Discussing food with girls on diets can feel eerily like porn dialogue. God, I would kill for a burger, like a big, bloody cheeseburger on a brioche bun and some caramelized onions. Ugh, brioche, you're so bad. What about some bacon? Fuck yeah, bacon. And some avocado and grilled pineapple rings? Grilled pineapple? You fucking pervert. 1 foot out the door. When you're a struggling actor, every job you get is a thrill and a relief. But unlike most professions, every job you get is temporary. The excitement is mired in the terror of knowing you'll be unemployed again in a matter of months. So even mid-movie, you have to send out your resume. For actors, that comes in the form of the self-tape. You can't make it to a casting office when you're shooting in the suburbs of Baltimore, so you and your castmates roll up your sleeves and put together a video in a trailer or a hotel room. Rocket Science, my second film, was basically a sausage fest. Luckily, the young men in the cast were gentlemen of the highest order and fine actors to boot. On a day off, we all went to one of the cast members' hotel room to help him make a tape for a mafia movie. We were young enough that this was an exciting project for all of us, not an obligation. Aaron read lines off screen, Nick operated the camera, Matt knew how to upload and send video. I didn't have a job to do, but I was happy to be there for moral support. True to any self-respecting mafia movie, there was a tremendous amount of shouting in that scene. We were all very impressed with the performance, but wondered if the surrounding rooms were annoyed with the volume. Several takes in, there was a knock at the door. A take was still in progress, so I jumped up to silence the curious party. I'm helping! Yay! I gingerly whipped around the door without letting it completely shut behind me, like I'd seen crew members do when we were shooting. Outside was a stern-looking woman from hotel management who softened when she saw me. I held a finger to my lips, apologetic and pleading. A man's angry voice was still emanating from inside. And now a teenage girl was desperately trying to get rid of the woman at the door. To someone who had no idea why hotel guests would be screaming for, you know, make-believe reasons, this development looked suspicious, to say the least. The hotel manager looked at me like, "Sister, if you're in trouble, I got your back." It was so courageous and supportive, I was tempted to let her take care of me. I quickly remembered that this was real life, and I figured ruining one take was worth it in this case. I threw the door open so she could see the collection of gangly young men filming their friend. Even in the throes of his heated performance, our resident artiste retreated from irate to meek instantaneously upon seeing the stranger at the door. We smiled nervously at the hotel manager. She looked us up and down. "It sounds like you're killing each other in here. If you're gonna make your little movie in the rooms, you have to be less dramatic." Special skills. Even low-budget films can be riddled with communication problems, and they only get worse and more frequent the larger the scale. As a result, I have learned a number of specialized skills for absolutely no reason. One film sent me to lessons on a horse farm for weeks. I wasn't learning to ride a horse, though. I was learning to sit behind someone riding a horse and not fall off. There wasn't actually a lot of skill involved. All you had to do was learn to spend an extended period of time clutching at someone's torso for dear life while galloping full speed, sans saddle or stirrups, on the aft of a sentient being, who weighed a literal half-ton and most days had a comically large erection. I panicked during my first lesson because something was digging into my thigh and none of the instructors seemed that bothered about it. Saddles aren't made to have a passenger behind them, so when I mentioned my discomfort, there was a general attitude of, "Yeah, that'll happen." When I pointed out the culprit, a metal ring about the circumference of a golf ball attached to the back of the saddle, my teacher frowned at it, gave it a tug, and said she'd try to take it off for my next lesson. Before you ask, believe it or not, I'm not the kind of gal who knows what purpose a metal ring might serve on the back of an English saddle, so no, I don't know what it was. It's just really digging into my leg, man. I'm not sure it can keep going. Well, I'm supposed to take you on at least 5 more runs. Do you want to take a 5-minute break first? Maybe drink some water? By the time I got home, I had a bruise on my thigh the size and color of a rotting mango. At one point, a renowned rider was brought in to work with me, a muscle-bound Spaniard who spoke almost no English. His connection with these horses seemed to transcend the laws of nature. On our first ride together, we galloped past the stables through the rolling sunlit hills. We took in the majesty of the countryside, and he turned back to me. "Beautiful," he said. "Yes, beautiful," I echoed. He cast his dark eyes away from me and gave the horse a kick. I gripped his chest and buried my face in his neck as we picked up speed, all the while thinking, when is this asshole gonna let me go home so I can ice my vagina? The day of my big horse scene, as I perfected my mount and dismount, the director said, "You know what? I'm never gonna use that. I'm gonna end the scene before you get on that horse." So I hadn't learned to ride a horse, and as it turned out, there was no reason for me to spend all that time training my inner thighs to endure blunt force. But it wasn't a total waste. I got to be outside in pretty weather, and I've got a head start if I ever get into S&M. I once played a chef, and although I did not get cooking lessons per se, I was sent to a knife skills course so that I'd look like I'd taken cooking lessons. In fact, I was flown from LA to Atlanta more than once on days I didn't shoot anything, solely for more lessons. I chopped piles of herbs, diced mountains of onions, cored bushels of apples. I got confident, but not especially good. This became clear when I sliced off a fingernail halfway through a pile of cilantro. Given the choice, I'd take a metal ring to the thigh any day. When we set up the shot for my vegetable massacre, the director took a look at the monitor and called out, "Hey, Anna, don't worry about the chopping. We can't see your hands." I've never driven a stick shift. Side note, I don't know why people act so superior about this. I don't churn my own butter either. Let's not act like I'm a dick for doing the easier thing. I was, however, asked if I would learn for the movie The Voices. The film was being shot in Germany, and the car that the producers chose, like most European cars, was manual. I expressed some hesitation but said that, of course, if that's what needed to happen, I'd learn. For 3 days, before and after work, I drove a beat-up stick shift around a former Nazi airbase with a patient stunt woman. Why a stunt woman? I have no idea. The scene demanded that I start the car, then drive precisely 10 feet, just out of frame. Not exactly the driver from The Driver. I joked to the producer that I was mostly worried about the other actress in the car. My scene partner, Gemma Arterton, happens to be a great beauty and a Class A broad, and the world would be cheated if we lost her to my poor driving skills. "You're learning to drive a stick for that one shot?" The producer furrowed his brow. "That's ridiculous." I was confused. Didn't he know that? Surely the days of lessons and dozens of emails coordinating them couldn't have happened without the producer's knowledge. An hour later, I got an email saying that a nearly identical car with automatic transmission would be used for my driving scene. I'm now pretty annoying about cutting out the middleman, aka ignoring the chain of command and bothering the person in charge of an entire film set about every little problem I have. Cake attack. On a recent film, we shot a scene in which a large wedding cake gets ruined. The characters all blame each other for the accident, and pieces of the destroyed mass are lobbed back and forth in frustration. The fun part was that we had to shoot some of the aftermath before we shot the cake destruction itself. In order to create the conditions of a cake fight aftermath, a cake fight zone was created. The art department commandeered a small room by the kitchen of the rustic hotel we were shooting in. It was the last scene of the day, and after changing into my wardrobe, I walked in, ready to be caked. Every surface was covered in clear plastic sheets. It was like something a serial killer would save on Pinterest under Dream Office. If you walk into a room like this and you're not shooting a movie, run, buddy. You are about to be dismembered. I stood in the middle of the room and the director, a grown man, my creative ally, threw handfuls of heavily buttercreamed cake at me while I shrieked, further tickled by every frosted assault. At one point, I started screaming, "Not the face! Not my beautiful face!" Don't get too into a bit when you're wearing 4-inch heels and standing in a pile of icing. I lost my balance and crashed to the saran-wrapped ground. At this point, I was laughing so hard I couldn't breathe, so I barely noticed. Two members of the art department wearing lab coats. Seriously, I was in Dexter's murderous paradise. Helped me up and steadied me. Then they turned me around and held my arms so that my boss could throw cake at my back. I squeezed my eyes shut and tried not to laugh and couldn't help but think, I am in the world's weirdest, most precious porno right now. It makes you feel like what? I will also have to sometimes fake the use and subsequent effects of illegal substances. Sometimes that's not difficult because I've got a good friend I can ask about it. Other times, it's a drug for which I have no point of reference outside of other actors depicting it on film. I had to do several lines of fake cocaine in a heavily improvised film, so I asked around about how it would alter me. I've been around coke, I've been at many a party where I was the only person not doing coke, but I've never tried it myself. I once secretly rubbed some residue on my teeth because that's what people do in movies, but I didn't feel anything. I didn't have much to go on. Luckily, most people in LA had experience with it. And in other places, actually. I remember conferring with other Maine expatriates after the first month of living elsewhere and confirming in disbelief that this was the norm. Do people do coke where you are? I know! Who does coke? Have they not seen any movie? It wasn't hard to find someone on set to walk me through it. So here's what I've got. Cocaine makes you feel like the most important, most interesting person in the room. Why on earth would anyone do this drug? No, listen. It's your time on earth, and I'm not here to judge anyone in this life. Except people who don't like dogs. How do you not like dogs? But that drug sounds horrible. Self-doubt is healthy. Self-doubt keeps me in check. It's the rare social interactions when I don't hate myself that keep me up at night. Oh, God. I just remembered the time in middle school when I thought I could pull off a wallet chain. I'm just gonna crawl under the bed for a while. Exploding Pig. Jake Szymanski, the director of Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates, liked to call out direction during takes so that we could work quickly and keep things spontaneous. One night, around 4:30 in the morning, everyone in the cast was collectively covered in fake pig guts. The scene didn't make it into the film, and explaining the setup would take forever, so you'll just have to go with me here. It had been a long day, it was getting cold, and I don't know why, but the fake pig guts smelled awful. It was like someone tried to cover the smell of rotting garbage with a full jar of nutmeg, but it didn't quite work. Luckily, we were supposed to appear disgusted by them, but they really were rancid. Jake was yelling out increasingly horrifying suggestions from the safety of his director's chair. They were all hilarious, but when he yelled, Zach and Anna, get some of the chunks of pig guts in your mouth so you can spit them out, Alice took over. Hang on. A note about Alice, my character, and Mike and Dave. I don't usually take my characters home with me, which is a method acting thing, not a sex thing. If it were a sex thing, I would do it. But Alice was a force to be reckoned with. She was hard to control. Maybe it was because we were doing so much improv, or because Alice said the things I wasn't brave enough to say, or because she's such an idiot. I like playing idiots. I tend to play smart because I look smart. Let's be clear, it's not because I am smart, I just read smart on camera. The two things are unrelated in actors. I let Alice have free rein a lot during that shoot. When the real Mike and Dave Stangle came to visit the set, I spotted them across the lobby we were shooting in and yelled, Get your dicks out! When they introduced themselves 2 days later, I pretended to be embarrassed about it, but I wasn't. Alice made me reckless and unflappable, so I was not going to be as docile as Zach. So, we're about to eat the fake pig guts. Hang on. A note about how sweet Zac Efron is. While we were making the movie, I was reading The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Zach struck up a conversation with me about my book and shared some stories about his Polish family coming to America during World War II. Then he took a breath to tell me an anecdote he'd just remembered, but stopped himself, like he'd thought better of it. I was going to tell you this thing, but it happened toward the end of the war, so... He smiled like a little schoolboy with a secret. I won't tell you yet. I followed his gaze down to my bookmark, nestled around the 100-page mark. Zach, you know I know how it ends, right? Yeah, but... It'll be better if I wait. What a sweetheart. So, we're about to eat the fake pig guts. Hang on. A note about the rise and fall of the Third Reich. It's a tome of a book, an absolute monolith. Now, the title has an air of legitimacy, intellectual curiosity, even gravitas. However, displayed on the cover of this beast, far more prominently than the title, is a huge, angry swastika. After a week of toting it around, I realized that having a Nazi symbol clutched to my person everywhere I went looked less than great. I got some electrical tape to cover it up and tried that for a day. Within an hour, the tape started to peel off, and a small but unmistakable corner of the emblem emerged, like a shameful secret, which was so much worse. Kids, it's not the scandal, it's the cover-up. So, we're eating the fake pig guts, and by that I mean Zach is putting the fake pig guts in his mouth. What a trooper. I, on the other hand, get in full Alice mode and scream bloody murder across the pool at Jake. Why don't you get over here and put this putrid fucking mystery meat in your mouth, you piece of shit! I said that to my boss. And the crazy thing was, I don't think I was joking. Luckily for me, Jake laughed really hard anyway. Zach went for it because he's a better person than me, and did a couple of really funny, really gross takes. He was so close to me that I could smell it from inside his mouth. Oh my God, how is he not throwing up right now? And then he threw up. I was barefoot. Sidebar. Working with Zac Efron gave me a real-life understanding of how Charlie Manson got all those people to move to a ranch and do his bidding. Hear me out! So last year I read this biography of Charlie Manson that managed to viscerally capture the atmosphere of the time and the mania of his followers, but I've still never been able to reconcile the whole, yeah, but why did anyone follow this guy in the first place question. 1 week of knowing Zac and I got it. Yes, Zac is unconscionably handsome, but I'm telling you that's not why people love him. And I am the first to discredit the achievements of the attractive and attribute their success only to their physical appearance. Charming, aren't I? People are just drawn to this guy. They behave like monkeys around him. Women behave like monkeys around most famous men, but it has more of a Magic Mike, aren't I being naughty vibe. Women fawn over George Clooney and think they're being cute. Men fawn over famous guys in a bro-love way and usually want to show off by buying the guy a drink. But you know those movies where some remote culture sees a dude in armor for the first time and mistakes him for a god? It's like that with Zach. People are drawn to Zach because he has the confidence of the alpha. In Hawaii, I once watched a pack of local teenagers shadow him around a series of waterfalls like they were baby birds on the Discovery Channel. It was as if they had no choice in the matter. We'd gone to do some cliff diving, and every jump that Zach was willing to try was soon mounted by the rest of the onlookers. Even the muscle-bound tourists and the aloof locals couldn't help but steal a glance after they'd hit the water to see if Dad had been watching. Based on his thrill-seeking recreational activities, I suspect some small part of Zach genuinely believes he's immortal. And honestly, he might be. That's probably what the magnetism is at its core. If there had been an electrical surge cutting off contact with the outside world, trapping us on the island forever, Zac Efron would have been the king of Oahu within 48 hours. Twilight. For those of you thinking, wait, she was in Twilight? I sure was! I was the sassy, awkward friend who broke up the relentless succession of intense stare-downs with musings on boys, tanning, and various school gossip. It was a sweet gig. The rest of the actors had to bring heart and honesty to fantasy situations involving life, death, eternal love, and the preservation of one's immortal soul. All I had to do was make jokes about how everyone was acting weird all the time. The best part was that I got all of the fun with none of the consequences. I got to show up to this mega franchise for 1 to 3 weeks per movie, bear witness to the madness, and act like an idiot. I was once allowed to go on a rant about the zombie apocalypse genre, which was mostly a shout-out to Edgar Wright, and it actually ended up in the film. And I wasn't saddled with the creepy super fame. Most of the cast couldn't walk out the door without being mobbed, but weirdly, the vapid friend from school didn't inspire the same zeal in fans. None of the other filmmakers I worked with during those years had ever seen Twilight, but the series kept me in room and board while I did their movies for no money. It was like the world's most ridiculous day job. I have a vivid memory of my first day on the movie. The cast and crew had been shooting for several weeks already, and I was brought to the set to say hello to the director before my first scene the next day. Usually a cast is happy to see additional characters. It's nice to get some new blood. Walking into the lunch tent felt like a scene from Band of Brothers. These were Tekoa men, and I was the idiot greenhorn showing up like, "Hey, bros! Who's amped to get in there and rip it up?" Kellen Lutz is the sweetest guy, but that day I think he might have strangled me if he'd had the energy. Kristen Stewart, one of the most committed actors I've ever worked with, made a valiant effort to be friendly, but I could tell she was putting her back into it. Underneath every word I heard, "You don't know, man. You don't know what it's like out there." Wet and cold is not an environment conducive to making friends. Imagine if the first 4 weeks of a new job were spent outdoors in the freezing rain. Even when you all got to go inside, you'd just want to sleep and defrost your toes. You can't create many inside jokes when you're mostly numb. We were shooting in Oregon and Canada, in some of the most breathtaking locations I've ever seen. I would have enjoyed them more if I'd been in galoshes and a winter jacket. As it happened, we were pretending it was late spring, and after my first 30 minutes on set, ice-cold water had seeped through my Converse and saturated my cotton socks. Only 14 hours to go. On a small set, I might have had the luxury of a fluffy coat to run to before and after a scene. On Twilight, I was referred to most often as number 44. A coat wasn't in the cards. I'd also like to mention the real MVPs of the Twilight movies, the background actors. Sometimes referred to as extras, background actors have the most thankless job on set. By the fourth movie, old number 44 had at least earned herself, sorry, itself, a coat. But movie 4 was brutally cold, especially the wedding scenes. Between shots, the background actors stood around those space heaters that do almost nothing, but they didn't have winter coats, and they would come back the next day. If you told me I had to be in that weather with no relief, I would have bailed like the little bitch that I am. Extreme cold messes with you. The elements don't discriminate. And no amount of, you're getting paid to do this, matters when your body's basic survival requirements are in play. Someone once told me that the reason most Navy SEALs drop out isn't because of the physical demands or the danger, but because they just don't want to be cold all the time anymore. So now, when I'm standing in a patch of wet moss and open-toed shoes and a strapless chiffon sundress, watching my breath fog in front of my face. Oh, sometimes they'll try and make you suck on ice so that they won't have to remove the fog in post. Don't fall for it. I think, you are a fucking Navy SEAL, Kendrick. You will get through this scene, you will say the stupid joke, and if you lose a nipple to frostbite in the process, it will be for art! We shot that chilly wedding sequence in the forest outside of Squamish, British Columbia. Squamish had a population of around 17,000 people, and as far as I could tell, only one hotel capable of housing a film crew. The production company rented out the whole place. The hotel was set back from the road and surrounded by grassy fields. My room was on the lobby level and faced the back of the grounds, overlooking a little lake and thick woods that started about a football field's length from my window. It was probably quite pretty in the summer or the deep winter, but muddy early spring gave it a foreboding quality. The only book I brought with me, I swear on my life, was The Shining. It was a large hotel, much larger, in fact, than our crew needed, so the place was eerily empty. Renting out every room seemed like overkill, but by the time we made Breaking Dawn, the twilight mania had reached critical mass. Certain precautionary measures had to be taken for the security of the cast and crew. So it was just us, the lonely patients of an expansive asylum. At least twice a day, someone I didn't recognize would be in the lobby getting kicked out as they protested that they really were waiting for a friend. The hotel staff knew no one was staying there but the cast and crew, and none of us had invited friends up because no one wants to come to Squamish. Beautiful country up there. I highly recommend a visit, perhaps with a non-Stephen King novel. I struck up a conversation with the receptionist, and she said that they were trying to stop people before they got onto the grounds, but the more innocuous-looking ones slipped through. The paparazzi, on the other hand, knew that legally they had to stay past the end of the long drive. She pointed down the road to 5 black SUVs parked and running just at the entrance to the hotel. Holy shit. I hadn't even noticed them before. I stayed in my room. The Paps didn't care about me. They were there for the Kristens and Robs of the world, but it was creepy knowing that they were out there. Inside, I had nothing to do. The internet didn't work, and the TV was Canadian TV. So against my better judgment, I read The Shining. Our wrap party was that weekend. I felt like I hadn't really earned the right to go to the wrap party, considering I showed up to film my entire role in the last 2 weeks, but I was happy to get out of the room. The wrap party was at the restaurant in the hotel, 30 feet from my room. Fair enough, still counts. I had a few drinks, heard some stories about paparazzi caught sneaking around the backfield, and after a while someone offered me some weed. The paranoia hit me quickly, so I excused myself. Thank God my room was on the same floor. I wouldn't have made it through an elevator ride without having a full-on claustrophobic breakdown. I got into my room and double-locked the doors. Then it hit me that being on the ground floor, overlooking these ominous woods, was not ideal in my current state either. I couldn't decide if having the curtains closed or open was more terrifying. Paranoia is one thing, but when people are actually watching you, it's hard to talk yourself off a ledge. I paced manically across the room, alternately looking through the peephole and the curtains on the back window. Why had I smoked weed in this creepy hotel? Why had I smoked weed after reading The Shining all day? Why did I read The Shining in this creepy hotel? I woke up the next morning to find all my luggage and a few pieces of furniture piled against the door. Chat, die, repeat. The best part of Breaking Dawn, and maybe the whole series, was when we shot a dream sequence in which I was a dead body. It was so much fun, and inside a room temperature studio! Kristen's character has a nightmare in which she imagines she's marrying her beloved, totally normal, nothing weird going on, only to discover that she's standing on a veritable funeral pyre of her closest friends and family. Man, those movies got dark. Before shooting, everyone in the scene had to line up in their perfectly white dream sequence outfits and get sprayed down with fake blood. That was someone's job for the day, to be fake blood spray down guy. Each of us then climbed into a preordained nook in an enormous pile of bloody mannequins, My nook was toward the top of the pile, near the happy couple, giving the impression that I was just underfoot. It was actually pretty comfortable, and I chatted with Kristen and Rob from my prostrate position. Then we'd hear rolling and action, and I'd hold my breath and fix my eyes on one spot. Then I'd go back to chatting with Kristen, occasionally making sure that the actors pressed around and under me weren't too uncomfortable. The spray down had apparently not been thorough enough, and after a few takes, a stocky crew member in hiking boots climbed up the pile and poured blood on us from a bucket. It was so awesome. Big breaks. Up in the air, aka, everything is amazing, everything is on fire. I spent the first few weeks of shooting Up in the Air certain that I'd be fired at any moment. I'd start to silently spiral before an important scene, and George Clooney would have to snap me out of it, usually by throwing something near my head. George has been famous for a long time and knows the effect he has on people. He has a skill for making situations feel relaxed and informal and keeping you in the moment. About halfway through the shoot, we all went to dinner. And for the 90 seconds of the evening where George wasn't dutifully chatting with excited restaurant patrons, I made small talk with him about the scenes we had shot so far. He laughed a little and expressed some reluctance to talk about how it was going because he didn't want to get in my head. I shouldn't say anything. I mean, no one wants me to say anything because, you know, you don't talk to your guy when he's pitching a no-hitter. Not being a baseball fan, I only vaguely understood this comment to mean I was doing well, but since it was exactly the kind of thing that might have gotten in my head, I decided not to look it up. I left the shoot happy and proud, and I couldn't wait to show the film to my parents and my friends and the rest of the world. I had zero suspicion that it would be an awards film. It seemed so light to me, so intimate. Oscar films are epic. They deal with war and death and destruction. Of course, plenty of Oscar-winning films are about regular people in everyday settings. I just truly hadn't thought about it that much. I was wholly unprepared for what came next. When the movie premiered at the Toronto Film Festival, someone told me things were about to get loud and fast for a while. Turns out loud and fast wasn't how it would feel. It felt like being one of those frogs that doesn't notice the water is boiling until she's standing in the middle of a hotel room crying in socks and a stick-on bra. From September 2009 through February 2010, I was on a non-stop promotional tour in support of the film. During those 6 months, Up in the Air debuted to critical acclaim, I was nominated for an Academy Award, and I finally saw that video of a baby panda sneezing. Not a bad half year. Yet it was perhaps the most confusing period of my life. The press for Up in the Air was a beast because it was all so serious. I didn't want to let anyone down, so I tried to take it just as seriously as everyone else. You can't imagine how soul-crushing it was for my misanthropic ass to be sincere for 6 months. I didn't know what I was doing, but the stakes seemed unbearably high. When everyone around you is acting like this is the most important thing in the world, you start to believe them. Nowadays, if you need me to do a radio tour, which is essentially 3 hours on the phone giving sound bites to various shows around the country, I'll probably clean my bathroom mid-interview and mention my vagina at least once. If you throw me in a room full of tastemakers, whatever that means, I still don't know, I'll turn on my personal brand of awkward, sarcastic schmooze and hope for the best. Because now I understand that they might love me, they might hate me, but no one's gonna die. But back then, each successive task felt like the most critical thing I would ever do. Every event was an anxiety-inducing clusterfuck or an exercise in solitude and tediousness. Now I know it's all a farce. I know how to snap myself out of it. This is not hard. This is not forced manual labor or the Cuban Missile Crisis. At the time, the pressure of these unfamiliar situations rattled my already shoddy emotional equilibrium. There actually was a weird side effect. I was in soundbite pageant mode so much that I started compulsively saying deeply honest, often inappropriate things to people I had just met. I had to come up for air. The only people I was interacting with at the time were fancy folks at fancy events, but if you weren't a journalist, you were probably going to hear about my most recent sex dream. I'm sure these people just wanted a nice evening out and perhaps some sparkling banter from the young actress. What they usually got was an earful on my fear of mortality. People ask me now if I get nervous about being too honest on social media. The alternative is much more terrifying. The crazy wants out. I felt like a fraud. I was being flown around, staying in hotels I could never afford, and putting on clothes that someone else picked out. When I went home, I dragged a suitcase full of those items I didn't own across my tar-stained carpet and dumped it out at the foot of my IKEA bed. Each time I locked the door to my squalid apartment, I grew more fearful that my filthy secret would spill out. I am, at best, a normal human, and this has all been a big misunderstanding. A lot of people were devoting a lot of energy to maintaining the illusion that I was the ready-made ingenue. It made me feel disingenuous and guilty, I was participating in a con. Sometimes I found it all too funny for words. I'd be at an afternoon tea in the penthouse suite of the Chateau Marmont wearing some boat-neck sundress and think, 2 years ago, I choreographed a fake music video to Fergalicious.